And welcome back. This is Daily Buddhism Audio Show number 23. I'm Brian Schell, your host for the show. You can find the text for everything in this show and all past episodes on our website at www.dailybuddhism.com. Many of this week's topics sparked some interesting responses which are posted as comments on the website. Some of them I'll read here. Remember, there's more to read at the website than just reposts of the daily emails. You can find many insightful comments by readers there as well. And keep your questions coming in. Send in your questions on Buddhism or related topics to dailybuddhism@gmail.com or phone them in at 937-660-4949. There's no question too small or too basic. Sometimes the deepest thought goes into the little stuff. You can also post your thoughts about anything we discuss on the website's blog at www.dailybuddhism.com. And we had an interesting assortment of topics this week, so let's get on with the show. The first thing we have to cover this time is a quick announcement on the companion website to the Daily Buddhism. For those of you who get the Tao of the Day emails, and especially for those of you who don't, the www.taoofthedaycom website is restarting with a new translation, as of last week. We just finished the James Legge translation, and this past Tuesday we began one by Tao Huang. It's far less poetic, but it's also much easier to follow, I think. It's a lot clearer than the previous translation. So if you joined up too late to get into the earlier episodes, or if you just couldn't follow along with the previous one, or you just never got into it, now is a great time to get started. You can sign up for the daily email at www.taoofthedaycom or subscribe to the daily audio podcast there as well. And just for a sample, I'll include the very first podcast for the new Tao of the Day at the end of this show. Just stay tuned after the regular show ends. And then we started out the week with a question about karma. A reader recently wrote in, "I am thinking about your discussions about karma. I would like to contribute my thoughts. The idea of karma, in my life, serves a profound function. My interpretation of it is simple. I see it as simply cause and effect. I do not ask whether or not my actions will bring me back as a cow or a goat, etc., but instead look into myself for guidance in the immediate moment with loving kindness. Animals serve me as a contemplation, metaphors for themes that emerge in my life, such as vengeance, hate, indifference, and joy, during my meditation practice. Whether a person is Buddhist or not, everyone knows that harming another person is bad, is one of the precepts. When I harm someone else, I feel bad, and I see that the other person, or sentient being, feels bad as well. The consequences of my action at harming someone is instant. This bad feeling may manifest in a more protracted, harmful way, or a more subtle way. Who cares if I know there will be a consequence later? Conversely, when I'm good towards someone else, there's a more positive outcome within me. Karma happens, like gravity. Buddhism's idea of karma never even enters my mind. If I have harmful thoughts, wrong intention, it's the first step to doing bad things. As simple as stepping on a beetle. Thought leads to action. True enlightenment is the absence of intention. Buddha was not looking for disciples. They came to him. Things were not written down, warm hand to warm hand. I don't think that he cared if I became enlightened or not. But he did care about my well-being through his expression of compassion, kindness, and wisdom. I care about the well-being of others. Buddha guides me." And my response to all that was, wow, excellent letter. Well, karma is there. There isn't anything you can do about it. Now, you cannot know if you're coming back as a human in a better position or as a cow. You can't revolve your life around ideas of karma. As you said, follow the precepts, Show loving kindness and compassion for others. Do no harm. Help where possible. And karma essentially takes care of itself. As you said, it's a lot like gravity, a force of nature that you just have to accept, not try to control. You couldn't even if you wanted to. Now, we've spent a lot of time here talking about the precepts. For the most part, the precepts deal with the right action portion of the Eightfold Path. Much of what you said involves right intention and right mindfulness, two areas that we don't get into as much as we should. All of these are important to you to not only understand, but to practice in our everyday lives. And then it had been a while since we did the last book review, so on Tuesday I did one of those. The book is Buddhist Scriptures, edited by Edward Kanzi. And there's a link on the site to order it from Amazon if you'd like. It's important to read modern Buddhist thought, such as books by Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama. However, in order to fully appreciate what those men are saying, it's crucial to have at least a good foundation in classical Buddhism. And this book will help with that foundation. This book has about 250 pages and includes most of the basic scriptures of Buddhism in excerpts and small bits. There's no need to read a 900-page archaic text to learn the story of King Milinda, for example. Well, the important bits are right here, condensed into a section in the Wisdom chapter. It's what you need to know, condensed. Buddhist cliff notes, if you will. Now here's the chapter list, and each chapter is broken down into several subtopics. There are chapters on the Buddha's previous lives, the legend of the Buddha Shakyamuni, morality, meditation, wisdom, doctrinal formulas, doctrinal disputes, other worlds, and the Buddha of the future. Now, as far as the level of the book, this one does have a lot of long Indian and Pali names in it, so you have to read closely sometimes to remember who's who. But that's not strictly necessary in most cases. You'll figure out who's important to remember by context. The book covers all the basics that we've discussed here in the Daily Buddhism, but includes a vast number of ancient legends and stories to support the ideas. If you like our koans, for example, here on Daily Buddhism, there's a lot of that kind of thing in this book. Some sections are easier to read than others, but there's nothing here that most of us can't get through. It's worth it. The book also explains various ideas from more than one denominational viewpoint. Some texts are important to Mahayanas, others to Hinayanas, or Theravadas, practitioners. And the editor explains why the texts are important to each group, as well as some of the history behind them. It's an inexpensive book at about $10 and commonly available. Like I said, I've got a link to Amazon on the website. It includes a wide variety of material, and I suspect I'll be referring to stories from this book in the near future. I like the way it presents big ideas in small packages. What could be more appropriate for the Daily Buddhism than big ideas in small packages? And speaking of koans and old stories, our story for the week is called A Buddha. In Tokyo, in the Meiji era, there lived two prominent teachers of opposite characteristics. One, Unsho, an instructor in Shingon, kept Buddha's precepts scrupulously. He never drank intoxicants, nor did he eat after 11 o'clock in the morning. The other teacher, Tenzin, a professor of philosophy at the Imperial University, never observed the precepts. Whenever he felt like eating, he ate. But whenever he felt like sleeping in the daytime, he slept. One day, Unsho visited Tenzin, who was drinking wine at the time, not even a drop of which is supposed to touch the tongue of a Buddhist. "Hello, brother," Tenzin greeted him. "Won't you have a drink?" "I never drink," exclaimed Unsho solemnly. "One who does not drink is not even human," said Tenzin. "Do you mean to call me inhuman just because I do not indulge in intoxicating liquids?" exclaimed Unsho in anger. "Then if I'm not a human, what am I?" A Buddha, answered Tanzan. And since we're saving the big topic for last, we will do the Dhammapada now. This week we're up to Chapter 7 of the Dhammapada, entitled The Venerable Arhat. There is no suffering for him who has finished his journey, and abandoned grief, who has freed himself on all sides, and thrown off all fetters. They depart with their thoughts, well collected. They are not happy in their abode. Like swans who have left their lake, they leave their house and home. Men who have no riches, who lived on recognized food, who have perceived void and unconditional freedom. Their path is difficult to understand, like that of birds in the air. He whose appetites are stilled, who is not absorbed in enjoyment, who has perceived void and unconditioned freedom. His path is difficult to understand, like that of birds in the air. The gods even envy him whose senses, like horses well broken in by the driver, have been subdued, who is free from pride and free from appetites. Such a one who does his duty is tolerant like the earth, like Indra's bolt. He is like a lake without mud. No new births are in store for him. His thought is quiet. Quiet are his word and deed. When he has obtained freedom by true knowledge, when he has thus become a quiet man. The man who is free from credulity, but knows the uncreated, who has cut all ties, removed all temptations, renounced all desires, he is the greatest of men. In a hamlet or in a forest, in the deep water or on the dry land, wherever venerable persons, Arhanta, dwell, that place is delightful. Forests are delightful, where the world finds no delight. There the passionless will find delight, for they look not for pleasures. And then what turned out to be the big topic for the week was a response to a phoned-in question.
Hi, Brian. My name is Mike, and I'm calling from the Central Coast of California. Thanks for your podcast. I've been listening to it for just a little while, but appreciate learning more, and appreciate your insight. I was listening to last week's episode about Christians and being the Christian who's sort of questioning his faith, and now looking into Buddhism. I'm sort of wondering where in Buddhism service fits in, service to others. Obviously, it's a big part of the Christian faith, but I don't know. I was in Thailand, and I saw some monks, and I just kind of got the feeling, this may sound bad, I just got the feeling they were kind of selfish, you know, like I wouldn't mind, you know, living in a temple and just studying, trying to make myself extremely happy and extremely peaceful, you know, with no responsibilities to anyone else. And I don't know, I just would like to know, or if you could address somehow how service to others relates to Buddhism. I know compassion for all life could include, you know, compassion for others, and maybe in our own capacity we can, you know, help or volunteer where we see fit, but I'd just like to know if there's anything you have to say about the matter. Thank you.
Okay, that was a great call, and exactly what I was looking for with the voicemail number. If you have a similar question, give it a call, 937-660-4949. And now back to the topic. Now remember, monks in a monastery have no possessions of their own beyond a few very basic items. They have no wealth to give away. They have no stuff to sell. They live entirely on the donations of others, and yes, the hard work they put into surviving. Sometimes they do sell things that they construct or craft, But the making of those items is still a form of work like anything else. With so little actual cash lying around, monks cannot afford to send money to starving children overseas or that sort of thing. However, they wouldn't hesitate to share food from their fields to help starving children in their own region if they could. In a traditional monastery, the majority of young monks spend the majority of their day working, either in the fields or building or other sorts of manual labor to support the monastery. Young monks often learn some kind of trade that will help them support the monastery during their time there, such as cooking, cleaning, woodworking, farming, laundry, or something else along those lines. Some of the monks may hang around town with begging bowls, but usually not the majority. The oldest monks, of course, fulfill their obligations by teaching others. Now remember also, monks are the elite of Buddhism, if there is such a thing. They have sacrificed family, possessions, comfort, and all the things we love in the West in order to meditate and achieve enlightenment full time. Meditating for 10 hours a day is not fun and games. They have a specific goal they want to reach. The Buddhist lay people in the East realize this and do what they can to support the monks, not necessarily the other way around. Anyone can become a monk over there, and in some places, everyone does spend a number of months in a monastery. But few choose to stay, because it is a very hard life. New recruits to the monastery must often work 18-hour days for 3 to 6 months before they can even begin the process of being ordained as a monk. The lay people support the monks' physical needs. The monks support the layperson's spiritual needs. It's a symbiotic system that's worked out well in the East for thousands of years. However, with modern economic systems, things are starting to change. The whole idea of living on the region's donations, whether it be donations of money, food, or supplies, does not work so well here in America, and the same problems are starting to crop up overseas as well. And that was what I had to say on the matter. But then I posted that I'd like to hear your thoughts on this as well, and that brought on a whole string of well-considered ideas on the website. I'll read a few of them here, but there are more on the www.dailybuddhism.com blog. Check the comment section under this post, and there's quite a few good ideas that we can look at. The reader Colin posted on the blog, "This is an interesting point, and something I've thought a lot about myself. However, in a nutshell, Thai monks, being Theravadin, are more inclined to devote their time to personal enlightenment, as that is the primary objective of their beliefs in attaining nirvana. They are setting an example to others of what can be achieved, and as you said, the local lay people understand this and respect their commitment. They attempt to reach nirvana with the intent of others following their example. In Mahayana, the objective is more to help others, and by doing so, reach nirvana that way. I initially found this aspect of Theravada Buddhism selfish, but on reflection, it comes down to a simple difference. One group says, I go, and hopefully you can follow me now that I have shown the way. And the other group says, I help you to reach my level, and then we can all go together. Neither way is better, in my humble opinion. It's just a personal or cultural preference. I hope my explanation helps in some way. And then reader Jesse adds to that, monks, in all traditions, perform an essential spiritual task. What is important to remember is the critique that sees monasticism as useless, unproductive, producing bone-idle men, is offered from a particular tradition within a Protestant capitalist work ethic frame of reference. Within that tradition, the criticism may be valid. Outside it, it must be deemed offensive, if not inapplicable. No Catholic would view monasticism as not central to Catholicism. Likewise, Buddhists must revere the relationship of monasticism to the Sangha. I'm interested to know if the criticism of the Thai monks was due to them absorbing other values. It could also be true that administratively, the monasteries in many states do not meet classical expectations. And if this is so, then it may not be issues strictly to do with meditation for long hours, but instead bad organization, which ultimately may have something to do with contemporary state politics in Thailand itself. Then reader Lonnie chimed in and said, "You can also see the shift in the West. The Catholic Church used to have numerous contemplative and mendicant orders. You just don't see them anymore. Are there even any mendicant orders functioning as such? I've heard that many of the contemplative monasteries have closed for lack of funds and members. I always have to remind myself that much of the good works done by the churches in the West are done by the organization, not by the individual clergy. I have heard of many Theravadic monks and leaders who teach and help others on the path. I believe it is the responsibility of an enlightened leader or government to aid the poor and afflicted. I think the compassion of the religious orders steps in when the leadership of the people fail. I think in the end, the West will change Buddhism in two ways. First, since there is no inherent tradition, all sects will be on an equal footing and allow individuals to choose. In Thailand, you would have to work really hard to find a Zen master, I would assume. Just as the Catholic Church has had many different orders to meet different personal needs, like Benedictine contemplatives, Jesuits, scholars and teachers, Franciscans, etc., all Buddhism leads to the same end. Some may start with Theravada scholasticism and a deep study of the Pali Canon, but may move to Zen or Tibetan mysticism later. I think it's a wonderful gift, all in all, to have that opportunity never seen in the ancient world. Second, there will be new versions offered that are unique to the West. There is much criticism of Western Buddhism by more traditional skeptics, but I would be willing to bet that by the same process occurred with the introduction to China and Tibet. That process took hundreds of years to sort out. Buddhism has only really come to the West in the past 50 to 75 years. We are much too impatient. Time will tell. And this is just my two cents from someone just starting out on the journey." And then Jesse responded to that post, "Lonnie, nice response and sensitively observed. The last bit, on the arrival of a new tradition in a novice country, is accurate. It raises the issue of what influence will a generally spiritually absent group of societies, such as the West, can bring to classical Buddhism. China, of course, was fertile ground for broadly dynamic influences, Taoism and Confucianism. A blending of ideas can produce a creative stimulus, as in the process of Chan, or Zen, Buddhism. But those factors do not appear to be present in the West, as you indicate with the decline of the Catholic monastic orders. Just a thought from a curious heart." And then Lonnie wrote back, "Jesse, you make a good point about the spiritual absences of the West. An optimist would say that there was an empty bowl waiting to be filled with the Buddha's teaching. I'm a little more of a pessimist and think that there is a layer of clear plastic wrap over the bowl. It looks empty, but nothing can get in. I see that wrap as the hyper-individualism we see in the West. People fail to see the advantage, fun, joy, and sense of belonging an individual gets by working in a group. I wonder if it is easier for those from Eastern cultures that are still more community-oriented to let go of self. This would be an interesting question for Brian to explore. I think part of the individualism has to do with the collapse of most of the community ties that come with the unlimited mobility we now have. I spent 14 years in the military and have to say it was among the happiest times in my life. Why? Because you are a part of a large group with common goals working as a selfless group. Leave aside for your thought what those goals might be, but I'm dealing with just the concept here. You could get the same feeling from the Peace Corps, or community organizing, or being a Franciscan helping the poor in South America. As I said, I've just started this journey. I'm looking for a tradition that I can settle into like a good Zafu. The Theravada is monastic-centric and more focused on the individual seeking. I really like the Mahayana idea of the Bodhisattva, but do not feel comfortable with all the religious trappings of Tibetan Buddhism. All practice have great universal ideas. It's just the cultural trappings that do not appeal to me. I'm not a Tibetan or a Thai. My culture affinity is Western. I think scholastic modality of Theravada appeals to the Greek academic side of the Western cultures, combined with Mahayana worldly inclusiveness of the Bodhisattva. That is where I would like to go. I don't know if this is just ramblings. I'm still sorting out ideas. And there were several more responses along these same lines in the discussion. Stop by the website to read more. Feel free to leave your own comments. Maybe you don't have such advanced, well-thought-out comments as these guys, but leave your comment anyway. We'd like to hear it. And that's it for this week's episode of Daily Buddhism. Stay tuned for a free preview of the Tao of the Day, Chapter 1. And as for the Daily Buddhism, if you aren't already subscribed to the podcast through iTunes, then don't forget to do that and you'll get every episode, every week, automatically. There's also the Daily Buddhism daily email list, where everything happens first. Go to www.dailybuddhism.com and sign up for the daily mailing. Send in your questions and comments. Also, if you'd like to support the show, there are donation buttons on the website, or you can leave feedback on iTunes for the show. So, see you next week, and stay tuned for a very quick sample of the Tao of the Day podcast. If you'd like to subscribe to this one, follow the links from the dailybuddhism.com site. It's every weekday, 5 days a week, usually for about 2 minutes, so it's very short. Here you go. Welcome back to the Tao of the Day audio show. My name is Brian Shell, and I am your host as we go through one chapter of the Tao Te Ching each weekday. Remember that you can get the full text of this chapter, read or leave comments on the text, or download back episodes of the show at www.taoofthedaytoday.com. That's www.taoofthedaytoday.com. And now, on with today's chapter. Chapter 1. The Tao that is voiced is no longer that of the eternal Tao. The name that has been written is no longer that of eternal name. The nameless is the beginning of the cosmic universe. The named is the mother of the myriad creatures. Being at peace, one can see into the subtle. Engaging with passion, one can see into the manifest. They both arise from a common source, but have different names. Both are called the mystery within the mystery. They are the door to all wonders.